James and I were discussing before services began how that with the coronavirus and the shutdowns and the turnarounds and all that we are trying to do, that sometimes it's confusing to try to remember what we used to do. And that's a real good introduction, I think, to the things that I want to talk with you about tonight. If you would open your Bibles to the Old Testament text of Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 25, reading beginning in verse 8, prophesied about the time when the period of captivity would end. The interesting thing is that Jeremiah is prophesying the time when it would end before it started. And you'll notice in Jeremiah chapter 25, reading beginning in verse 8, the text says, "Therefore, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, because ye have heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send unto Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, will bring him against this land, and against all the inhabitants thereof, and against all the nations round about. And I will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment and a hissing, and perpetual desolations. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of myrrh, and the voice of gladness, and the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstone, and the light of the lamp. And this whole land shall be a desolation, and an astonishment. And these nations shall serve the kingdom of Babylon 70 years." Now, that thought continues into the first portion of the next paragraph, verse 12. I want to include that in our reading. He said, "And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith Jehovah, for their iniquity in the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it desolate forever." Now, I wanted to read this because it identifies a period of time. Daniel references some of these things in Daniel chapter 9. And if you'll turn to that chapter and read with me beginning in verse 2. Daniel chapter 9, verse 2. The text tells us in Daniel chapter 9, verse 2, "In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel," well, begin at verse 1. "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years whereof the word of Jehovah came to Jeremiah the prophet, for the accomplishing of the desolations of Jerusalem, even 70 years." Now, that's not there by accident. Daniel is referencing the thing that we read in the book of Jeremiah. Now, keep in mind that Daniel and young Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as we know them by their Babylonian names, young Daniel, as we read of him in Daniel chapter 1, and these other three young men, were taken from the city of Jerusalem and became captives of the Babylonians. Daniel, knowing what Jeremiah had prophesied, his life has spanned from a very young man, spanned the reign of the Babylonian kings, and now we find that he is living during the time of the kings of Persia. And Daniel, being familiar with the Old Testament prophecy of Jeremiah, said, "We're nearly there. We're nearly through with this period of captivity. It's about time for us to go home." Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah chapter 44, beginning in verse 27, and said, "Be dry, I will dry up thy rivers. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I come loose, I will loose the loins of kings, to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut." And someone might say, well, what does this have to do with what we're talking about tonight, Nick?
Well, I want to tell you.
Those Old Testament characters that were contemporary with Daniel, who were taken into Babylonian captivity, could look forward to the time when a decree would be written by the king of Persia, Cyrus, which would allow their release from captivity. Now, they could look forward to that time because Jeremiah had stated the number of years. They could look forward to that time because about 200 years previous, Isaiah had named Cyrus before he was ever a twinkle in his mother's eye as the one who would write the decree and allow them to go home. Now, Daniel was no dummy. He could do math. He knew how old he was when he went into captivity, and he knew about when that prophecy then was due to be fulfilled. Now, my question to you as we introduce our study tonight is, they are privileged to return to the land, but it's been 70 long years. Do you think they remembered exactly what it was like in Jerusalem? Well, some of them had been born in captivity. They'd never been in Jerusalem. Some of them, like Daniel, remembered the way it was in Jerusalem before the Babylonian captivity ever became a reality. And some of them didn't go home. Some of them throughout the Babylonian Empire had made their living and established their lives in other places, and they did not go home. Some of them anticipated, no doubt, with great joy, what it would be like to go home. Some of them had no idea what home was. Someone had commented to me this morning that it has been a year since they were able to come and comfortably be with God's people in this building. A year. And so, after the passing of a year, we reflect and say, well, some things have changed. Some physical characteristics, no doubt, are different from what they were. And we have looked forward to the time when we could resume something that resembled normal. Would you say that's so? Indeed. Some of you have expressed to me what a joy it is to be able to do that, to gather together with the people of God and to worship. And it's not like on Zoom where you may sing, but you really don't hear others singing. You're not really encouraged by the association together like we are this morning and tonight. And after a year, we come together with great enthusiasm and excitement and say, well, we're able to do somewhat what we used to be able to do. We can resume something that resembles normal. Now, brethren, I want to reflect upon that in light of many of the passages, and you see part one on the board. This is not intended to be an exhaustive one-lesson study. But what I want to do is to examine what they anticipated, examine what they planned to do, and then to examine reality. Because I would suggest to you that what they wound up doing was not really what they had intended to do. And the joy that they thought they would experience when they came into the land and think that everything's going to be just like it was 70 years ago, they met with the sad reality that it was not. They were not the same people. The place was not the same as it had been. And while they were away, a lot of things have happened in the city of Jerusalem and in the province of Judea. And we want to study this period of time. I mentioned to Linda a moment ago, it's a very intriguing period of time to me because I'm persuaded that there are many similarities. Though we do not have a 70-year national shutdown, they did. And their lives were dramatically changed. And we look at 70 years and we say, well, that's a generation of people. Yes, it was. and to examine when they came back into the land with great anticipation of restoration. That when they came back into the land, their excitement soon waned. And we want to talk about why and what was to be done to change that. Now, having said that, to introduce our study, turn back with me to Ezra chapter 1. In Ezra chapter 1, we read of the beginning of the return into the land. I guess I could push a button or two here and get us on the right chart. Jerusalem indeed was to be built, but permission to go home included all the tribes of Israel. It included the northern 10 tribes that had been taken captive by the Assyrians. But now Babylon has taken over the southern kingdom and has conquered the city of Nineveh, consequently taking the Assyrians captive. And so the Babylonians now are in control of the captives that the Assyrians had, as well as their own from the southern kingdom. And now we find that Cyrus has overcome the Babylonian Empire. And a chart that I find quite significant, and I know some of you may have a little trouble seeing it, is during the period of the Assyrian Empire, here on this little speck on our map, is the kingdom of Judah during the days of the king Hezekiah. Now you'll note that Hezekiah was a good king. He expressed confidence and faith and trust in God. And consequently, the kingdom where Hezekiah was, the city of Jerusalem, was not conquered by the king of Assyria. But only a short time after, when the Babylonians began to conquer, where do you see Judah on the chart now? The Babylonians conquered the city of Jerusalem. The southern kingdom was taken into captivity, just as God had said. And now the southern tribes are scattered in this great vast empire of Babylon. You see how and why these promises that were to come through Cyrus, who at the point at which these prophecies were made, he had not yet been born. Why it was so promising to the people of Israel to see the time begin to pass on the timeline, and now Cyrus is king of the Medo-Persian Empire. And he controls all the territories that were once held by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians. And just as Isaiah had said, long before Cyrus was ever born, this decree had been made to allow them to go home. Now, many of the Israelites, as we mentioned, stayed where they were. It's been in their history, some of them, including those from the northern 10 tribes, it's been somewhat 200 years since they were first taken into captivity. Depending on what sources you may read from, by the way, Samaria fell in either 721 or 722 to the Assyrian kings. The most recent captives had been gone for about 50 years. Some of them have built homes where they were. They're happy where they are. They're employed, as it were, where they are. They're making their living, and it was their choice whether or not to go back to the land of Palestine. They didn't have to. They could stay wherever they were and where they felt comfortable. Jews from various tribes are mentioned in the New Testament, as you can see in Luke chapter 2 and in verse 36. Interestingly enough, when these captives were allowed to return and this decree was made known, in the year 536 they began to go back into the land. About 50,000 Jews gathered in Babylon to start home. Now I want to tie together Ezra and 2 Chronicles. Now you know that the Kings and the Chronicles are parallel books, much like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are parallel in respect to the life of Christ. But the Kings and the Chronicles give their accounts of this period of time preceding their being taken into captivity during the days of the Kings. And in 2 Chronicles, you'll note beginning in verse 22 of chapter 36, it says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of God by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdoms, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, All the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever there is among you of all his people, Jehovah his God, be with him, and let him go up. Now that's the last verses of the book of 2 Chronicles. Now when you begin the next book, the book of Ezra, Ezra was one who led a group of captives home. And it says in chapter 1 of the book of Ezra, Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah might be, by the mouth of Jeremiah, might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all the kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, king of Persia, All the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever there be among you of his people, all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whosoever is left in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, and besides the freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Now I want you to note what Cyrus has said. If you don't go home, if you want to stay here, that's fine. But you give gold and silver, and in other words, you help fund your brethren so they can go home and rebuild. And so it was done. In Ezra chapter 1 and Ezra chapter 2, we read about Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. These are names named as leaders of the people of Israel, these Jews who are going back into the land. Some have said that we don't really know whether these two different men or two different names, or these are two different men or two different names for the same man. I don't know the answer to that. But what we do read in Ezra chapter 2 is the number of those that were returning from Babylon. In Ezra chapter 2, reading and beginning in verse 64, it says, The whole assembly together was 42,303 score. Besides their men servants and their maid servants, of whom there were 7,337. And they had 200 singing men and singing women. And you can read the number, and it is just short of 50,000 people that are returning to their homeland. So they're on their way home. Now though Cyrus has said, the Jews that remain, you help them. You give them money and resources to be able to be to rebuild. We're going to see how that Cyrus, who was the king of Persia, played a part in the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. Now we might note just here that there weren't any gods that were returned to the Jews, and the reason why is they worshipped one God, and he was not an idol, so there were no golden images that were to be returned to these people. But what we do know is that the Jews had about 5,400 gold and silver vessels that were taken from the temple when King Nebuchadnezzar conquered the city of Jerusalem and returned these items unto the people. The Jews who stayed behind helped their brethren with the things that were necessary to make their task easier. It was a day of great joy as they started home. However, the challenges that were in front of them were not going to be easy for them. They provided or profited the people that came into the land. This is one of the things that I think sometimes we miss in our study. We think that because the king of Babylon took people out of the kingdom of Judah, and specifically the city of Jerusalem, and made captives out of them, and when Shalmaneser, the king of the Assyrians, conquered the northern 10 tribes and took people away, we think, well, the land now is just desolate and it's there and nobody did anything with it. Keep in mind that there were those who were identified as the Samaritans. We'll talk about them in a bit.
But the king of Assyria, he would import people from other nations that he had taken captive, as well as export people from the area where he had recently conquered, mixing the people. The resultant people then, the intermixing of the people, were the Samaritans. Now the Samaritans, during this 70 years period of time, they had grown in power. They had claimed the territory around the ruins of the city of Jerusalem. And you'll note that those who were identified as Ammonites, they moved out of their near desert territory into the fertile highlands of the land of Gilead, where we see it was a great place for grazing cattle and sheep and that kind of thing. And the Edomites, they moved out of the dry Negev into the land that once had belonged to Judah. And so they took the city of Hebron. And then the nomadic tribes moved nearer these fertile lands and established a more settled way of life than the nomadic life that they'd had in such barren, desolate areas. Now let me ask you, brethren. Most of you, I know, have traveled east from Mojave. And you've been out in the desert. I used to tell folks when I first moved to Lancaster, they say, where you live? I say, in Lancaster, California. That's in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Well, it's not in the middle. So I had to correct that. There's a whole lot of Mojave Desert. And coming from Arkansas, where there's lakes and streams and green stuff almost every direction that you look, and you go out into the barren desert. When Donna and I first drove into this part of the world, I said, look at all these for sale signs. Who would want to live here? Wonder what they would pay us just to take it. And then we got into town and we found out that folks are kind of proud of this barren desert. But you take it out east from here, out into the Mojave Desert, and ask the question, how easy would life be in a place like that when you had within just almost a day or two walk fertile, beautiful, lush, green, watered land? You see, we have discussed in our studies of history and geography of the Bible the importance of the land of Palestine strategically. We have discussed why this was a land that was selected by God, that He said flowed with milk and honey. And as He brought the Israelites up out of the land of Egypt, He brought them into this area. Well watered and well fed. Fertile land. Now once the Babylonians and the Assyrians had taken the Israelites out, leaving only a small portion of influential folks, what do you think that the tribes surrounding them did? They stayed out here where it's barren and desolate, or did they just move in onto somebody else's land? Well, they just moved in onto somebody else's land. And so you've got the Samaritans, the Ammonites, the Edomites, and these nomadic tribes that moved in to where Israel was. And now what did we have? Well, we've got a change of things that are taking place after the fall of Samaria and the fall of the city of Jerusalem. So when Cyrus writes this decree saying you can go home, home really wasn't home anymore, was it? Things have changed. They came back into the land and lo and behold, there are folks that are living there. And they're not just willing to say, well, here, you used to own this land. Why don't you just take it? They had established their homes there. And so when we have a return of the people, the Jews, to the land that God had allowed them to be restored to, it wasn't going to be a real easy task. This period of return involved a whole lot of things that were very traumatic for them. Very discouraging in some ways. And I want to suggest to you, as I mentioned in our study this morning, brethren, we have a lot of work to do. The cause of Christ has suffered, at least in my judgment. Perhaps there has always been a lot of work to do. But as we talk about subjects like salvation, redemption, reconciliation, these are subjects that the vast majority of people in this very town don't know anything about. And we have a responsibility to teach folks what needs to be done. not to be distracted by discouraging things, things that would overthrow us, like Israel of old was. Now, as we study this period of Old Testament history, we might want to note that there were actually three returns. These three returns we can read about in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. The Jews returned home under the leadership of Zerubbabel to build the temple. The book of Haggai we're going to be studying because Haggai returned to help the people to rebuild the temple. Ezra returns with the priest to start the spiritual reforms that needed to take place. Nehemiah returned with a very specific task at hand, and that was to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Now, to begin this work, it was not going to be an easy task. But when they come back to the city of Jerusalem in the third chapter of the book of Ezra, let's do some reading. First of all, notice with me, beginning in verse 10. Ezra chapter 3, verse 10. It says, "And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites and the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise Jehovah after the order of David, king of Israel. And they sang one to another in praising and giving thanks unto Jehovah, saying, For he is good, for his loving kindness endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Jehovah, because the foundation of the house of Jehovah is laid. But many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses and the old men that had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off." Would it be fair to say just in that reading that there's mixed emotions on the part of those who have returned? As we mentioned earlier, some are anticipating great things, and some are remembering how it was and convinced that it will never be that way again. As you begin into the fourth chapter, we note that they met with some difficulties. In Ezra chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of captivity were building the temple unto Jehovah, the God of Israel, they drew near to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the fathers' houses and said unto them, Let us build with you. For we seek your God as ye do. And we sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, Ye have nothing to do with us in the building a house and building a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto Jehovah, the God of Israel, as Cyrus the king of Persia hath commanded us. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building." Oh, we got troubles now, don't we? Things are not what we thought that it was going to be. So this day that we thought was going to be such a great and marvelous day is not such a great and marvelous day. Well, we know that during this time, the Samaritans, as we read in chapter 4, they wanted to help, saying, "Well, we believe in the same God you do." No, no, no. When we turn back to the Old Testament text in 2 Kings chapter 17, we read of the origin of the Samaritans. A very interesting study. For there we learn that the people that are imported by the king of Assyria into the land began to be eaten of the lions that were in the land. And they cried to the king of Assyria, saying, "We don't know the gods of this land, and so consequently we're in trouble. We need to learn the God of this land." And the king of Assyria sent back one of the priests that had been taken captive to educate these people about the God of the land that they lived in. And I think what that priest taught them is evidenced by the results that he got. Look in your Bible in 2 Kings chapter 17 and begin reading in verse 32. It says, so they feared Jehovah and made unto them from among themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. Dropping down, you'll note verse 41, so these nations feared Jehovah and served their graven images. Their children likewise, and their children's children, as did their father, so do they unto this day. Now let me ask you, my beloved friends and brethren, why were the children of Israel taken captive to start with? Well, it was because of their idolatry, wasn't it? Yes. These priests, were they the priests of God? Well, no. What really then do they know about the God of Israel? Well, not much. If they had been teaching about the God of Israel, the people of Israel would not have been taken captive to start with. But the results of these priests indicate that they had simply identified God of the land of Israel as another notch on the totem pole. And so all these people now are doing is just adding him to the list of the gods that they already serve. They're practicing idolatry. And my friend, here is the origin of the Samaritans. Now in Ezra chapter 4, when the Samaritans said, let us help you build the temple, for we serve the same God you do. No, you don't. No, you don't. We'll build the temple, and you won't have any part in it. Now do you think that made friends with the Samaritans? Not hardly. Not hardly. It enhanced their hatred for the Israelites. But this is what we're dealing with during this period of time. So adversity begins to slow and stop their work almost as soon as the foundation is laid. And as you open your Bible to the book of Nehemiah and read with me in the second chapter of Nehemiah, verse 17, it says, then said I unto them, ye see the evil that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. What a noble statement. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat, the Horonite, that is, he was a Samaritan, and Tobiah, the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem, the Arabian, heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. Now, what's Nehemiah told these folks who are the enemies of the people? This is our job. We'll build the temple. We'll build the wall. We'll take care of these. This is our business. And you go on your way. This is not your affair. Well, did that make friends with these people? Well, no, not really. It just continued to enhance the problem. And they wrote a letter to the new king of the empire, the Persian Empire, Cambyses. He was Cyrus's son. But Cyrus is dead, the one who wrote the decree. And they said, well, what you need to do is you need to find out that these Jews are bad folks. They have a bad history. They're very troublesome to the people that live here. And so consequently, you need to stop this. And so Cambyses wrote a decree, and he stopped it. So now we find that the work that they had intended to come back and do now can't be done because the king made a decree. You can't do this. And as you begin to turn the pages in the book of Ezra, you find out that the people of God said you need to check the books a little more carefully because Cambyses' dad wrote a decree telling us to do this. And what did they do? They searched the books and they found out that that was exactly the case. And so those who were then inhabiting the land, who were presenting opposition and trying to use Cambyses to stop the work of the rebuilding of the wall. When search was made and it was found out that Cyrus, his daddy, had said, you authorize these people to do this. He said, they're going to do this. And you're not going to trouble them in doing this. But the Jews there stood accused of nothing less than treason. They had to prove their innocence. And so Cambyses checked the record, and as a result, then the people continued to build. But now we got a problem. Remember, it was Haggai that was going to lead them in the rebuilding of the temple itself. And as you turn to the Old Testament book of Haggai, he tells us what the attitude of the people was. Now keep in mind, they knew that this 70-year period of captivity was ended. They knew of the decree that Cyrus had written, allowing them to return. And they come back with great enthusiasm and anticipation of what it's going to be when they get back. But then when they get back, they find, well, we've got enemies. And because we've got enemies, well, we can't build the temple. We can't do this. And so what we find out then is that when Haggai returns, he sees that the people have a disposition about them that they don't want to build. And if I can find the book of Haggai, there it is. Haggai said in verse 3, then came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your sealed houses while this house lieth waste? Now therefore saith Jehovah host, consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it in a bag with holes. What's happened? Do you see how things have changed? Ezra came back and laid the foundation. And then they met with opposition and the work ceased. Investigation had to be made to see if they were even supposed to be building the temple. Found out that it was. But what's happened to their attitude? Their attitude has now become one of indifference. Yes, we can build the temple. But because we met with opposition and because the work ceased, we just don't have any incentive to start building again. Oh, we were very enthusiastic, but not anymore. Because with the passing of time, we've become indifferent. And Haggai says, what on earth are you thinking? Consider your ways. You live in your own sealed houses. You've had time to build your houses. The opposition has been present. You built your house. But the house of God still lies in waste. Now you think about that. Do you see any similarities between the circumstances perhaps that we're in and the circumstances that they were in? Except for us, it's been a year. For them, it was 70 long years. There's plenty of work to be done, brethren. There's much work to do on every hand. And so we want to note that Cambyses continued to push the borders of his kingdom. He succeeded in taking Egypt and ended the reign of the Pharaohs. He learned of problems at home. He went back and he died on the way. Now, that's a good place for us to stop just now. Because what I want to do in this series of studies is to examine carefully what they found when they came back into the land, what they did, and how it was changed. What they needed to do to go forward with the work. In our next study, we're going to talk about Darius the Great and talk about what he did. Now, the time has changed. We've talked about Cyrus, who wrote the decree. We've talked about his son that had to examine the record and see that this is what the Israelites were supposed to be doing by the decree of his father. And Cambyses had a son, and his name was Darius. Darius the Great. And we're going to see what he did as far as the Israelites or the Jews were concerned and how things went forward from there. Now, having said that, I want to extend the Lord's invitation. Maybe I'm talking to somebody who needs to respond in obedience to the gospel. You're not a Christian. Nobody knows that better than you. Why not fix that? You understand what it is to be lost? These people did. They understood what it was to be away from their homeland, to be separated from God and that sort of thing. At first, they were glad to be able to come back, but their attitude soon changed. If we can help you by baptizing you into Christ with the commitment, I'm going to be faithful to the Lord, I'm going to serve Him all the days of my life, we'd be happy to do that. But maybe you've obeyed the Lord and the new has worn off, like it did with these people. Maybe you found that opposing the world is not as easy as you thought it was going to be. And you've become discouraged. Maybe you've fallen away back into the world. You need to fix that, brethren. Be right with the Lord. If we can pray with you and for you to that end, that's our desire. Come to the front. Let us know as we stand and sing this song.